All right. Well, good morning. Today we're at going to be starting in Numbers chapter 18 toward the end. Last time we were in Numbers beginning in the first verse of 17. And we saw the Lord clearly establish Aaron as his high priest. They were asked to bring rods and put their names on the rods, one from each tribe. Aaron represented the tribe of Levi. The rods were placed before the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, and Aaron's rod sprouted. Not only did it sprout, but it grew buds, and it even had ripe almonds on it overnight. And clearly God had established Aaron in that role of high priest. God said his own purpose was so that the people would quit complaining, quit trying to usurp Aaron in his role that God had given him, so that, God said, they will not die. And, of course, the people's response when it's all over, they come to Moses and say, we're all going to die. Why? Well, they recognized, they said, if you come near the temple of Jehovah, then you've got to die. And they had become aware of the fact that God was putting up with no more of this kind of rebellion against the ones that he had chosen, the rebellion against him and his choices as for the priesthood. And so they saw it as definitely a threat. Not much response is given to that in the scriptures, but they continue forward as a people. And when we turn over to Numbers chapter 18, we covered the first 24 verses of that last time, and God goes into the duties of the Levites. That's his response to their comment about if you can't come near the temple. So what does God do? Through Moses, by God speaking to Aaron, I'm sorry, I said through Moses, but through Aaron, God speaks to Aaron, and he says, here's the duties of the Levites. For Aaron and his son and his high priests, they are to be in the priestly role. The rest of the Levites are to serve them, to help them in meeting their obligations for things to do with the temple and worship. But the altar and inside the veil and that holy furniture is high priests only. And then in verses 8 through 24, God establishes the portions of sacrifices that are not required to be burnt will become the property for the priests and the Levites. The meat for the clean males, they can consume that. The other offerings are for all clean people in the households to partake in. And part of what God gives them, he says, by the way, the firstborn is mine and I give it to you, not only of men, or not only of animals, but also of men. He said, surely you're going to redeem the men, 5 shekels of silver, then freeze the men from their ownership. And so that would be paid for redemption. And then unclean animals are to be redeemed. And then the offerings and holy gifts that are brought become the property of the priests. Now God says to Aaron in the process of all this, your inheritance among the people will not exist as it does for the others. The other tribes, it's the land and so on, which we'll learn more about later. But God says, my inheritance, or your inheritance is me. You get me, and that's going to be your inheritance. It will be perpetual through all the generations. And so when we get to the point we get to look at what happens with the land, we will get to see the priests do have some things provided for them, but in terms of the normal operations of things, they don't get the land masses like the other people do. Which brings us up to chapter 18, verse 25. And so we're going to cover the last part of chapter 18 today. And this is an important part of what God sets out for the priests. The Lord spoke, this is verse 25. Then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, moreover, you shall speak to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the sons of Israel the tithe which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present an offering from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe. Your offering shall be reckoned to you as grain from the threshing floor or the full produce from the wine vat. So you shall also present an offering to the Lord from your tithes, which you receive from the sons of Israel, and from it you shall give the Lord's offering to Aaron the priest. Out of all your gifts you shall present every offering due to the Lord, from the best part of them, the sacred part of them. You shall say to them, when you have offered from it the best of it, the rest shall be reckoned to the Levites as the product of the threshing floor and as of the product of the wine vat. You may eat it anywhere, you and your households, for it is your compensation in return for your service in the tent of the meeting. You will bear no sin by reason of it when you have offered the best of it, but you shall not profane the sacred gifts of the sons of Israel, or you will die. And so the rest of the people make a tithe of the things that they receive, plus there are the offerings of first fruits and those kinds of things that are made. And so the Lord tells Moses, this is an instruction you give the Levites. You tell them, when you get these tithes from Israel, which I gave to you as an inheritance, because those were given to God, right? So God says, okay, they're yours. Then you're going to give a tithe offering to Jehovah, a tithe of the tithe. So it is their function to also be tithers. Just because they received the tithe from God doesn't mean that then they are not also in the role of giving and supporting things. And it's a tithe offering to Jehovah. It's to be used for his glory. And he says, you count your offering just like the others would count a harvest. That's a point of saying it's just like coming from the field. In verse 27, it says, reckoned as grain from the threshing floor or the full produce from the wine vat. In other words, when you receive it, yes, you didn't grow it. You didn't harvest it. You didn't bring it into the household. But when you receive it like it was your work done to harvest it. It would be the same as the way we would look at what is received by the ones that actually did grow it and did harvest it. There's a tithe to be given. And so that is to be presented to Aaron, the priest, the representative of God. The offering is to be presented to Jehovah. And like the rest of the offerings, it's to be chosen from the best. God calls that the sacred part. So as they receive these tithes from the rest of the people as their tithe to God, and then it gets transferred to them, they don't look at the choicest parts and go, oh boy, looky what I got. No, they look at the choicest parts, the holy part, the best of it, and they make their sacrifice out of the good, the best. And Moses tells them in verse 30, once you've given it to them, once you have made the offering, once you have kept your tithe, then the rest belongs to you like it would in the harvest. In verse 31, eat it anywhere. Don't be embarrassed about it. Don't act like you've got to hide the fact you're eating out of this tithe. You're eating out of what was given to God from the people, and God gave it to you, and that's your compensation. It's reasonable. It's correct. It's okay to go out and be noticed in your consumption of that. Don't be embarrassed by it. And it's not wrong to do that. It's no sin in verse 32 to use it as you wish after you have tied the best part of it to God. And the warning, but don't profane the sacred gift of Israel or you will die. What did God just tell them through Moses here? How would they be profaning the sacred gift? What could they do that would do that? I stumped you? That wasn't the goal.
She's been the best to treat it as though they were common instead of profane. So maybe that would be a good service to be flippant about having it.
Okay. I think they could be flippant about it, and that would be certainly offensive. But the obvious thing here is how would people profane their own tithing? What's that?
By not giving a tithe?
Absolutely. I'm getting close to 10%. That's good enough. because that's what a tithe means. And clearly, probably the easiest way for them to profane it is to fail to see the that if you are presenting your tithe, then it's not truly the best. In other words, not taking the time to truly see that what you give up is of the best. The really good stuff is what's to be tithed. And you may indeed have some really good stuff left after you've made the tithe, but there is an homage to God. There's a function of worship here. There's a recognition that you got this from God to begin with, and now you're giving back this tithe in worship. And God has said you will give of the best, and that's what's expected. But not just because it's expected. If you truly desire to be obedient to God, to serve him well, to serve him in a worshipful way, aren't you going to be excited about giving him the best? But if you're trying to figure out how you can keep that kind of wine and not this kind of wine, so I'll give him the kind I don't like as well, that's not going to be a good thing, is it? And so they could easily profane it by not holding the attitude that God is looking for. This is your act of worship. It's your act of showing your love and your devotion to God, your obedience to God, and it's been asked that you give of the best. Now, I want to turn the words just a little bit as I say this, because what they're really doing is they're recognizing God's role in providing for them. True? So as they're giving this, how could we easily profane the way that we look at God's provision for us? You know, we've got to look at these things and not just talk about them, right? How might we be profaning the giving that we do or the giving that we fail to do? How might that profane what God has provided for us? I've probably made the question so obvious that the answer is contained within it. Do you see the point? God provides for us. And in this nation, I mean, there are many of us that struggle to make our finances all work all the time, right? There are many of us that don't. But even for those of us that struggle, our level of prosperity in this nation is pretty astounding. Now, in these days, we could go to some other nations and find some pretty strong prosperity as well. But they're pretty limited. And so God has given us so much. How might we profane the recognition of what we have as we live out our lives here?
Grumbling.
Complaining and not being thankful for what he provides day to day.
You know, it goes back to the old John Rockefeller story, doesn't it? At the time he was asked this question, he was definitely the richest man in the world, and he was out trying to figure out how to make a little more money, and somebody asked him, well, how much is enough? Oh, just a little more. And it's always just a little more, isn't it? I mean, as we achieve some financial success somewhere or have some financial milestone go by, we still look out and say just a little more would really be nice, don't we? Now, I'm not saying that's wrong, but when that becomes your focus, that's a problem. How else? There's some real key things here that I think we ought to be saying. How else might we profane the things that God has given us, whether we're feeling it's abundant or not so abundant today?
By claiming that I've worked so hard.
Look what I did. No. No, you didn't. The scriptures say, what do we have that God did not give us? With an intended answer of nothing. And that's absolutely the truth. Maybe I applied some skills, and I applied them in such a way that I made a profit or got a good paying job or whatever. Well, where did I get those skills? Oh, you inherited those. Well, where do you think the gene pool started? You know, let's get real about this. God established mankind. He created him in Well, our image is the actual words, isn't it? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So if I'm created in God's image and I go out and work with that, I can't take credit for being created that way, can I? Now, certainly there's something to say for, and Dave's going to preach on it again today. We're going to have a series of lessons that is right on and appropriate that we need to be workers in this world. That's a part of what God created us to do and be, so our efforts should be involved. But nonetheless, apart from what God's giving me, my efforts gain us nothing. Just the fact I put effort into it doesn't guarantee a good product. And so it just seems like mankind's curse is the more he has, the more pride he has. That's a trap. That is a huge trap. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? Oh, look what I have done. I have conquered the worlds. I've made these great cities. I've done everything. God says, I hope you enjoy grass. Your pride didn't do this, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, it was told, God used him in order to bring chastisement to the people of Judah. And so God raised him up to be his tool. And you know, one of the stories in the Bible that I really like a lot is the story of Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar was very much a high ego, prideful ruler. Look at what he did in letting his people set up the statue to him with the ordinance. If you don't bow to the statue, you go in the fire. And we get the events of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? God took that prideful man and turned him into one of his servants by the way that he chose to humble him. And so Nebuchadnezzar recognized God and proclaimed God before his life was over, and I think that's a great story. But when we see the things we have, pride is a way to profane what God has given us. There's nothing wrong with taking satisfaction in knowing that your labor and efforts went into it, but when you say, look what I've done, that's a little bit over the top, maybe a lot over the top. I want to go to 1 Chronicles 29:14. 1 Chronicles 29:14. This is during the time that David is he's proclaiming and he's in prayer regarding the gifts that were given to build the temple, which God didn't let him build, but Solomon was going to. And this is David's heart poured out here. Verse 14 of 1 Chronicles 29, but who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? For all things come from you, and from your hand we have given you. David got it right, at least in this case. Why is it, God, that we're able to make this great offering? It came from your hand, and back to your hand we give it. We're just giving you what you have already given to us. It's yours already, and we're just putting it formally in the offering for your purposes in building the temple. Okay, questions, comments? I am convinced, and I don't know how I'm ever going to get a good reset on this. I'm convinced that today we're going to end up not at the easiest place for me to break it either. But that's okay. We'll work at making that work. But let's go over to chapter 19 in Numbers. And this is a precious passage. It's a little bit I wish there were more words in the scriptures about how to tie it into many other things. But there's enough here, it's still very precious, and I want us to really take a good look at it. So let's start with verses 1 through 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the sons of Israel that they bring you an unblemished red heifer in which there is no defect and on which a yoke has never been placed. You shall give it to Eleazar the priest, and it shall be brought outside the camp and be slaughtered in his presence. Next, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of it toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, its hide and its flesh and its blood with its refuse shall be burned. The priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it in the midst of the burning heifer. The priest shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and afterward come into the camp, but the priest shall be unclean until evening. The one who burns it shall also wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and shall be unclean until evening. Now, a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. The one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And it shall be a perpetual statute to the sons of Israel and to the alien who sojourns among them." So in this first section, we see the command of God given to Moses and Aaron, and said, this is a statute, this is a law that you're to tell the sons of Israel. And we get the mechanics of an offering that's going to be made here using a red heifer. And we'll talk about that, and then there's a lot more to say before we get done with this chapter and tying it all together. And so they're to bring an unblemished red heifer with no defect and where no yoke had ever been used on the heifer. Now, as we go through this, in trying to put the pieces together of how this red heifer offering fits into their worship then and even has implications yet today, you can't help but run into Jewish tradition and the way that the rabbis have brought this forward and some of its history in terms of, at least in terms of traditionally, the use of this red heifer offering at various times. And so first I want to bring you something from the Jewish screening process put out by the rabbis in selecting a red heifer, not for this day necessarily, but as time went forward. You know, rabbis are like the rest of us. They like to write and talk and put things out. And many of the things are good. Some of them you go, where did you get that from? But so here are some things that could disqualify the red heifer. And there are others. I didn't make a complete list. But it could never be ridden on or even ever had anybody lean against it. If a garment had been placed on the heifer, it was disqualifying. If a bird had ever rested on the red heifer, it was disqualifying. If, in examining the whole heifer, you can find 2 black or 2 white hairs, it's disqualifying. So, as time went on, when they looked at this red heifer offering, they were real, and I think if we understand the spirit of what they're trying to do, they're trying to make sure they really have a red heifer that fits what God has asked for here. And so they have gone to great lengths to say, well, you know, if somebody leaned on this, that's kind of like making it a working heifer, and so we're not going to do that. In the simplicity of what we see here, basically, it's an all red animal that has never been used as a working animal. And it's a fairly young animal, probably somewhere around a 3-year-old animal. And So they're to bring this. In verse 3, we go on and it says, give this heifer, once you've got it found, to Eleazar. Who was Eleazar?
Aaron's son.
Aaron's son. As a matter of fact, we could go a little bit further. Based on the order that they're all mentioned, this is probably Aaron's oldest remaining son, because he lost two already. And so Aaron and his sons function in the high priestly role. So in some sense, with regard to Aaron at least, he's a deputy high priest. But he's high priest. And the other living son was Ithamar. But so what is Eleazar and the people to do once they brought the red heifer to Eleazar there in verse 3? What are they supposed to do with it? Take it outside the camp and slaughter it in front of Eleazar. Now, once again, if we looked at what the rabbis have written about how this is to be done, that some of the things that they said is they have designated what type of rope the heifer is to be led around by, what direction the heifer is to face while it's being killed, slaughtered, some specific words to the high priest to say, and by the way, everybody has to wear sandals. Now, why, I don't know, but that's some of the things, and there are more. That's some of the things that they had placed on top of that as time went by. They're going to go out, and they're going to slaughter this animal in the presence of Eleazar. Now, Eleazar then is to take some of the blood on his finger, in verse 4, and sprinkle it toward the front of the tabernacle. And he's to do this 7 times. And I worked at trying to visualize this, because earlier we got an idea of how the camp was typically laid out, right? Where is the tabernacle? Where? It's in the center. And what's around the tabernacle? All the tribes. And on one side in specific, we have the tribe of Levi and the priestly function. So how many people we have? Well, when we left Egypt, we had 600,000 men of fighting age. A few less now. There's been a few events where God has taken some of them out, but it's still a large group. So now they're outside the camp, they've slaughtered this animal, and Eleazar is to take some blood on his finger and sprinkle it toward the tabernacle 7 times. Everybody I read put it in their mind that apparently Eleazar goes in the camp and does this. He gets some blood on his finger, goes into the camp and does this near the door of the tabernacle. And I'm going to say that's wrong. It doesn't say he doesn't do that. But certainly here, everything's happening outside the camp. So either he's going in the camp, or it's just in the direction that it would be toward the tabernacle in the camp. And so he's going to sprinkle this blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. In verse 5, then the heifer's to be burnt in his sight, and it's everything's to be burnt. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its refuse shall be burned. And then the priest, and this priest isn't necessarily named, it might be Eleazar, but the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it into the midst of this burning heifer. This is going to have to be quite a blaze to consume this heifer, so they've got to have quite a fire going, and these things are going to be put into it. And those things that he put into it are associated with cleansing. I don't think we'll go over and read it, but one of them, in Leviticus 14, 1 and following, we see these things used in the cleansing actions for someone who's had leprosy. And when we look at this, we know that hyssop has been associated with sacrifice many times. It's been used in the cleansing, often by being a tool to sprinkle blood with, and other kinds of things. We can even look forward in John chapter 19. Jesus says on the cross he's thirsty, and they use a sponge to give him some, as I recall, it was sour wine. But what do they put the sponge on? It's held on a hyssop branch. I would like to go over and look at Psalm 51:7. Psalm 51:7. And this is David in Psalm 51 lamenting and confessing and pleading with God over his sin. And this is one thing he says in verse 7. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Hyssop is associated with cleansing spiritually over and over and over again. We see it in the sacrifices, and we see it here. I also want to go to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9. And we're going to look at verses 18 through 21. In the book of Hebrews, there is a comparison and contrast constantly going on between the time under Moses and the Old Covenant versus the time under Christ and the New Covenant. There is a comparison between the priesthood under Aaron and the priesthood of Jesus that is not under Aaron. And as a matter of fact, it comes under the order of Melchizedek, which means it's directly from God. And there's also warnings about, so because you see these contrasts, don't choose the lesser. Don't choose the one that really didn't solve man's sin problem. Choose the new covenant where sins are truly and fully and completely dealt with through Christ. And these are some of the words that come out of that comparison between the old and the new, verses 18 through 21 of chapter 9. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." In the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with blood. And so in this comparison, we see that hyssop and scarlet were both used in the original dedication that was done by Moses for the new covenant. And he did it surrounding the book when he wrote down the law. And so these materials being used again here in the red heifer fit right, red heifer sacrifice fit right in with all that we know about what we see in the scriptures about the times that God uses the sacrifices to move people toward healing their relationship with him. There are some very special things about the red heifer. I don't want to equate it with all the others, but we're not quite there yet. So when he's to put all of these things into the fire to be consumed with it. And then if we go back, let me get my scriptures back open, go back to verse 7 in Numbers 19. We see that then the priest is commanded to wash his clothes and bathe his body in water afterwards and then come into the camp, but he's not clean until evening. And also the one who did the burning shall also wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and be unclean until evening. So they also then assign in verse 9, a man who is clean gets to gather up the ashes of the heifer And they go to a deposit outside the camp in a clean place. And it's going to be want to be preserved because the congregation, the sons of Israel, will keep it as water to remove impurity. It's purification from sin. And we're going to see how that gets involved with the water and removal of sin as we go through, as purification from sin as we go through this chapter. So these things are all coming together under the oversight of Eleazar. His function is the sprinkling of the blood, but then we have somebody else performing the killing of the animal and somebody else doing the burning of the animal and another person to gather up the ashes when it's all done. And he says, the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. This is going to be a perpetual statute to the sons of Israel and to the alien who sojourns among them, to the visitor that comes into their presence. And so we're going to get more details as we go through this about how these things function with regard to the people. Questions, comments so far? I feel like I skipped a Hebrews passage, but maybe it comes later. Yes, it comes later. Okay. So let's look at verses 11 through 22. What did I say wrong? Yeah, 11 through 22. So the rest of the chapter. We'll see if we can get this all put out here today. The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died, and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord. And that person shall be cut off from Israel, because the water for impurity was not sprinkled on him. He shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. Every open vessel which has no covering tied on it shall be unclean. Also, anyone who is in the open field touches one who has been slain with a sword or has died naturally or a human bone or a grave shall be unclean for 7 days. Then for the unclean person, they shall take some of the ashes of the burnt purification from sin, and flowing water shall be added to them in a vessel. A clean person shall take hyssop and dip it in the water and sprinkle it on the tent and on all the furnishings and on all the persons who were there, and on the one who touched the bone or the one slain or the one dying naturally or the grave. Then the clean person shall sprinkle on the unclean on the third day, and on the seventh day, and on the seventh day he shall purify him from uncleanness, and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and shall be clean by evening. But the man who is unclean does not purify himself from uncleanness. That person shall be cut off from the midst of the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water for impurity has not been sprinkled on him. He is unclean. So it shall be a perpetual statute for them. And he who sprinkles the water for impurity shall wash his clothes, and he who touches the water for impurity shall be unclean until evening. Furthermore, anything that the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and the person who touches it shall be unclean until evening. And so in this section, we get a lot of instructions about handling an uncleanness that comes on people. They are unclean from touching a dead person or being in the tent with a dead person or a grave or all of these things. And it's a 7 day uncleanness. They are defiled. And so then in verse 12, we hear that, well, this is for, I'm sorry, verse 12. Yeah, verse 12. They shall purify themselves from this defilement with water on the third day, the seventh day. And then he becomes clean again. And so he doesn't lay it out there in verse 12, but he goes through these people that we see there, that if they touch a corpse and all the things I just mentioned, they become unclean, they're defiled. And so God has declared, you touch a corpse or these related things, you're defiled in my sight. But he also provided the directions for cleansing. And to not cleanse yourself after doing this, then you are let me go to verse 13, just read its words. You defile the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel, because the water of impurity was not sprinkled on him. If you don't go through the steps to become clean in God's eyes, that isn't just now you're just defiled. It means you've defiled the temple. I said temple, tabernacle. What's God really saying there? God is saying, here's my tabernacle. The tabernacle is his place of dwelling, right? And as he's in his place of dwelling, you're defiling God in his own presence in the camp. God has commanded you, he's saying to these people, you touch the corpse, you need to become clean again. You need to get rid of your defilement, and if you don't, then it is affront to me. You're defiling my own presence here in with the people. And so then he provides the directions for the cleansing. We get more clarity. But and the clarity comes like this. It isn't just water that they're to use, but they're to go back to the materials provided in this red heifer offering. And they are to mix some of those ashes with the water. This is to be done by a clean person. It's done in a vessel. And then that person on the third and seventh day and applies that water to them with a hyssop branch. And then on the seventh day after it's done, the person bathes and washes their clothes, and then at evening they're clean again. The defilement has been removed. And the person who did that then needs to wash his clothes, and he then becomes clean again in the evening. In the meantime, anyone who touches anything, anyone who is defiled, everything they touch is unclean. And in a tent where a dead body may have been, those furnishings can become unclean. If there's a vessel that doesn't have a cover on it, that's in the words here, strapped on, it becomes defiled. And so all of these things then need to be cleansed through what is done with these ashes in the water. And that's the process that God lays out to do this. In verse 21, he says this is going to be a continuing statute for the tribes. He lays out that anything or anyone touched by the unclean person also becomes unclean there toward the end. But I've rushed through that just a little bit because I want to talk for a little bit about this red heifer sacrifice and how it fits in with several different things. Because we've already been given some sacrifices to do, right? We've already been introduced to the sin sacrifice. We've been introduced to the burnt offering. We've been introduced to the peace offering. So where does this fit in? And I want to give you just a little bit of history from the Jewish tradition first. And as we talk about this, I think this will come to be. According to what the Jews have in their history, their tradition, there have been 9 red heifer offerings since the time of Moses. And these all occurred... the last one occurred, maybe is the right way to say it, as they're preparing to enter, they're consecrating the second temple, which would be the temple that Herod built. So they occurred in those places. So in all of those years, there were 9 red heifer offerings. Clearly, this was not brought into the practice where they did it periodically. Mostly, it's associated with the cleansing of the people to so they will be cleansed, and the dedication of the temple, so the temple will be dedicated properly so that they can worship God with a clear conscience and not be defiled in front of God as they do this. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Maimonides, now this is back, he lived 1135 to 1204, but he taught that there will be a 10th red heifer sacrifice that will actually be carried out by the Messiah. And I'm not trying to hold you up to the standard and say because he taught that, that's what we should all believe. But they saw this red heifer offering as being so central to things that that's one of the things that they expect to be a part of the Messiah's coming. And one of the things that they expect to be a part of the Messiah is going to be temple worship again. And those that have some focus on preparing to build a temple, I mean, this is out of the news in recent years. There have been 2 different times they've done this. But in 2022, for example, there were 5, quote, flawless. I don't know what standard they went to, but I'm sure they're very diligent. Red heifers that were selected in Texas and actually flown to Israel to be available should we want to dedicate a temple in any days coming up soon. Well, obviously, 2022 is a while ago, and those red heifers would probably be a little bit older. I'm not trying to hold this red heifer up as a part of the end times necessarily, or even things that will occur. It may. The Jews, if they build another temple, I would expect that the religious ones are going to be looking toward this red heifer offering and doing it again. But I want to take just about 3 minutes and focus on one thing, and then I want to go to some other passages, and I want to make some correlation between this red heifer offering and Christ, because there's some things we see here that point us to Jesus and his ministry. But first I want to ask the question, why this focus on defilement from touching dead people? Why is that such a part of this chapter, do you think? Well, let me start here. Matter of fact, we'll use some of these verses to get there. Let's start with Romans 5:12. Somebody probably has that memorized or nearly memorized. Romans 5:12. I'll turn to it because I always misquote things when I'm standing up front here. Maybe I'll turn to it. Okay, Romans 5:12. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all have sinned. Now, clearly, we're looking at Christ here, but the point I want to make out of this verse is that sin came into the world, and what came with sin? Death. The Israelites have just gone through another rebellion when God implements this red heifer sacrifice. And clearly it's intended to be available for all the people to deal with sin and its relationship, their relationship to God and being defiled in his sight. And he's associating it with death. Out of this last rebellion, what was God's judgment? Death. Death to who? Who was judged to die, that death would be a part of their future in a special way because of judgment after this last rebellion? Well, they were trying to be Levites, and those people were taken immediately. But the congregation as a whole, what was the sentence? 40 years. I guess that sentence actually came because they didn't go into the promised land. 40 years. You're going to wander. You're not going into the promised land. And what was to be accomplished during those 40 years? Death. This is a focus on a marching through time, wandering the wilderness. We have some other things we're going to be seeing happen during that time, but it's all about waiting for a certain generation to die off. They're going to be looking at death all the time. Not that it was at an unnatural rate necessarily, but these people dying is going to be a focus of this group for 40 years. And every time somebody dies, it's going to emphasize the why. Lack of faith, lack of response to God. And so God says to them, when you get involved with one of these dead bodies, you're defiled. And he gives them a way to become undefiled. And it comes because of their sin. Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death. And we could look back at Numbers 14 and watch their 40 years of dying that is to come. What was the message that Jesus brought? What's the good news?
Victory over death.
Victory over death? What's the bad news you have to know to understand the good news? Because Jesus' message was not to relieve people of the first death, of the physical death, was it? Jesus' ministry was to relieve people of the second death. And so what's the bad news you have to understand before you can get the good news of Christ and understand it? When you die, after death comes judgment. And if you die in your sins, you've got an eternity of punishment by God himself ahead of you, right? That's what people needed to understand. And so when Jesus came, he didn't come about physical death. He came about being defiled in the eyes of God because of sin. From Adam, clear up to your own sin. And how can we be set free from that sentence of second death? We too need a sacrifice. And the sacrifice that Jesus made has some very strong similarities, is connected with, this is a picture of, in certain ways, a type of the death and the sacrifice of Christ. The red heifer had to be what? What's the key thing? Perfect, without blemish. Jesus, too, had to be without blemish. And we're not talking physically here, are we? We're talking about Jesus being here and living as we have lived and gone through the temptations that we have gone through and lived in the skin of a man, both being fully God and fully man, but he was righteous. He was perfect, not just free from sin, but holy and righteous fully and completely in fulfilling the law of God. Now, that red heifer didn't do that. But that red heifer, his perfection had to be there physically for this physical activity. What had to happen to the heifer during the sacrifice? Shedding of blood. Now this one's a little different. This one didn't necessarily, did they bleed the heifer out, because they would collect the blood on most of their sacrifices, and the blood was used in various things for various ways as a part of their rituals. In this case, all of the blood except what is shaken by the finger of Eleazar was to be burnt up. But here Jesus too had to shed his blood. The scriptures tell us without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sin. And then there was the purpose of the sacrifice. We are told in Numbers 19 verse 9 is the purification of sin. And Jesus is there to do that. There's another very strong one. Go to Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13. verses 11 through 13. This is, again, that comparison. Hebrews 13, 11 through 13. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. So let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. And then it goes on to talk about, for here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. And it points our attention to heaven. But Jesus too was sacrificed outside the camp. And the writer of Hebrews brings that together. So the red heifer dealt with the outer man. Jesus, it was a type of Jesus coming. I don't want to say outer man like physically, but what I mean is in the temporal way. The real sacrifice for sin came through Jesus. And Jesus then dealt with us with the eternal payment for sin. The Old Testament people had to look forward to Christ, and we get to look back. But I want to go to Hebrews chapter 9 now, and this will be the last one. Verses 11 through 14. It says, but when Christ appeared, Hebrews 9, 11 through 14, but when Christ appeared as a high priest of good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Here, the writer of Hebrews draws the contrast between the blood of bulls and goats, and he specifically mentions the heifer, and how, while it was instrumental in the relationship between God and men, it was more ceremonial. And the blood of Christ then, though, is eternal, and it cleanses our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Questions, comments, thoughts? Well, we did find the end of it. I had to push just a little to do it. This is a rich passage. God was being very, very, very kind to the people to bring in this red heifer offering, to give them another point of focus, to set aside their defilements and heal the relationship between them and himself because of their great sin and rebellion. And that's what I have. Yes. Well, it's very limited. Okay, so for number one, I would not be prepared to get into the details of the end times with a great deal of specificity, with much specificity. But here's where we get the end times piece, where there will be a temple, because it talks about defiling the temple. It talks about the Antichrist setting up his image in the temple. So there are enough things that refer to the worship of a temple and the existence of a temple that we infer that there's got to be a temple that is involved in the end times. Now, is that temple, does it have to be built before all of the events that you see in the book of Revelation and in Thessalonians and other places? Not necessarily. We don't know those kinds of details. And I personally am hesitant to, let me just say it this way. I haven't drawn the conclusion personally with any definiteness that there's anything waiting on the temple to be built before it can be done. there are some signs that are given in the end times that involve the temple. So clearly, it's got to be there for those signs to occur. But in terms of the events that might occur for the church in the short run, I say short run, in the earlier parts of leading up to or in the earlier parts of the tribulation, I don't know when it has to exist, except for when those... I think so because of the words that are used about Jesus even talks about the abomination of desolation occurring. Or was that Paul? Anyhow, it's in the scriptures. You know the time is coming when you see the abomination of desolation. That goes back to one of the Jewish enemies. Is it Assyria or Syria? One of those two. I can almost say the name. I taught this once, many, many years ago in the book of Daniel, and I can't pull all the names out, but there was a ruler that was overtook them, and he sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple, and that was called the abomination of desolation. So there's a connection between something similar or the same that violates the sanctity of the temple that is done by somebody, by, I think, the Antichrist and his henchmen, in the latter days.
But the heifer itself, I mean, I see the representation, I guess, of the heifer and Christ. I see that. And so I'm like, is that Jewish tradition because they don't believe Christ was that sacrifice?
Oh, I think that's definitely a piece of it.
Okay.
But will there be another red heifer offering as they implement a new temple? Maybe. I don't see anything in New Testament prophecy or even anything Old Testament to point toward the end times that would require that. That may just be my own ignorance, just to be very clear. I mean, I didn't find anything in preparing for this. I don't think it's there, but if a guy looked hard enough, long enough, deep enough, it might be there, but I don't think so. Anything else? All right, well, thank you. We'll see you. Oh, we will not be in here next week. There is an all-church Sunday school next week, so we'll skip a week before we're back to this.